Thank you, brother.
I'm substituting. I'm listening for static, and I might get the wrong impression if you're talking. Well, I see everybody's back from your vacation from MBR2 just last week. How many have not yet made up the tape? Missed last week and didn't make up the tape? Okay, only one, two. Oh, you're switching to audio. But you haven't made up the tape yet? Okay. Those that haven't may have a little bit of difficulty following the lecture this week since it's a continuation of the lecture from last week. Just do the best you can, take notes, and then try to get that tape made up as soon as you can while this is still fresh, and then you can put it in proper order. I can't recall, did we have an assignment due last week?
No.
Yes? No?
Yeah, it was due last week.
Last week? Which was what? Okay, everybody handed that in that's going to, right? That's all. Okay. Okay, now, we're talking about one of the four main elements in some of the basic principles of Bible study. Those four main elements are observation, interpretation, evaluation, and application, and correlation. So we're looking at observation, which may be the most important, at least in some senses, because if you don't know how to observe, if you don't know how to look at the Word of God and really see what's there, it stands to reason that you're going to have trouble evaluating, interpreting, and applying what is there. You've got to see it, and you've got to really look, and look for certain things, and see how things fit together, and the laws of how things fit together, or how they relate. So this is what we're looking at, observation. And we've talked about the requirements for observation, the observation of terms, the observation of relations and interrelations between terms. Then we were giving you some laws of structure concerning modifiers and clauses, and we were giving you some illustrations of that within a paragraph. This is where we are right now. We are illustrating some relations and interrelations within paragraphs. In other words, some examples, some illustrations of how things relate and structure that you can look at. The first example, which we gave last week, but I think I said I might want to repeat it this week since we ran through it real quick before the bell rang. So the first example was showing you relations within a sentence. And this sentence was taken from what we would call a logical type of literature, in this case, the Epistle to the Romans. So we come to Romans 1:18. Now, I would say don't worry too much if you don't get every point that I get down. The main thing is that you see what they're saying. You see what we're saying and how these things relate. This is merely an illustrative example, and so it's not something that you have to get every word down. But Romans 1:18 was the example. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. All right, how does this thing relate? Well, the subject of the sentence is wrath, the wrath of God. So wrath. The article the modifies it, the wrath. And also the prepositional phrase of God modifies it. It's the wrath of God. So both the and of God modify wrath. Of God shows you who possesses that wrath. God possesses that wrath. And who is the source of that wrath? God is the source of it. Now you say, well, there's no revelation there. Well, there's no revelation, but except a lot of times you could read right past something like that and never notice that. You just read the wrath of God. See, but there's man's wrath, you know, and the old saying, hell hath no fury like a woman's wrath, you know, there's women's wrath, there's, grapes of wrath, there's God's wrath. And so this is the wrath of God. There's the source of it. There's the possessor of it. The main verb of the sentence is revealed. Is revealed. The wrath of God is revealed. But there's a prepositional phrase that modifies that. From heaven. Showing you where it's revealed from. Or where it is from. It's revealed from heaven. And it's revealed against all ungodliness and wickedness. So there's another prepositional phrase, against all ungodliness and wickedness, and that modifies is revealed. And as I say, from heaven indicates the source of that revelation, and against all ungodliness and wickedness reveals the object of that wrath, as well as the reason for the wrath. And of course, the adjective all modifies ungodliness, and all wickedness. Both, of course, are linked by the conjunction and. Then you've got a prepositional phrase of men, which modifies those two nouns, ungodliness and wickedness. Of who? Of men. And it indicates together, with that adjectival dependent relative clause, who by their wickedness suppress the truth, the possessors of the qualities denoted by the noun. In other words, those qualities, wickedness and ungodliness, are possessed by these men who by their wickedness suppress the truth. And then you can say, well, what about this dependent clause? You can break that down. Who is the subject of it? Suppress, of course, is the main verb of it. Who suppress? The direct object is truth. They're suppressing truth. But it's the truth. So they're not just suppressing truth, like 2 plus 2 is 4. They're suppressing the truth, meaning the truth of God. And the prepositional phrase, by their wickedness, modifies the verb suppress. They suppress it how? By their wickedness. So it's the wickedness of these men that is suppressing the truth. And then the entire clause indicates the expression of ungodliness and wickedness. What kind of ungodliness and wickedness is it? It's the ungodliness and wickedness of men who, by their wickedness, suppress the truth. You see? So all of these things relate one to another in the sentence. And the more methodical you can get in breaking these sentences down, and that's just working on the English version. And I realize there are pitfalls that have to be watched for when you're using an English translation. That's granted. But the fact remains that there's tons of truths that you can get from just looking at how these things relate to one another in the sentence. Question on that. Keith?
I was just wondering what translation you're reading.
I believe it's the ASB. We had problems with that last week, I think. I was giving you some examples, which I got from a book, and the examples were worded a little bit different than what we were using here in the ye olde KJV, and so I think that was probably the American Standard Version, which is sometimes called the American Standard Revised Version. Any other questions or comments on that first example?
Just like NASB, they have an end of unrighteousness.
Right, and they were based on the ASB, so that's probably what it
is. Fine.
Yeah. Now, example, I'm going to give you another example of this relations and interrelations within paragraphs that show you the laws of structure. This example will show you some main connections in an entire paragraph. And we're taking it from what you would call narrative-type literature, in this case, the Gospel of Mark. Chapter 9, verses 2 through 8. So, if you want to look at Mark 9, 2 through 8, we'll see again how things interrelate. And the truths you can draw from them. And again, I might add, for your edification and information, that it can be helpful to use a different version than what you are used to reading when you're looking for structure, interrelationships in the structure of paragraphs, relations and interrelations in between phrases, clauses, sentences, words, in a sentence or paragraph, because we've read the King James Version, for example, so many times that we tend to just gloss right over the words without seeing, well, let's see, there's a verb and it's modified by that prepositional phrase and so forth. We tend to just, it's just all in one ear and out the other. But when you're looking at another version, it kind of takes you back for a moment because you have to read it all over again to absorb it, and then you can, certain of these structures can stand out a little better. I'll tell you another one that would be excellent for that, for this type of study too, and that would be Rotherham's translation, since by his series of signs and signals, he shows you emphasis and structural relationships. For example, in his metrical version of the Psalms, where he shows you modifiers, he lines them right out and shows you parallelism and lines the parallelism out and the contrast and so forth. And so his can be very good to show you structure and modifiers. Okay, Mark 9, 2 through 8. Read through it first. And after 6 days, Jesus taketh with him Peter, James, and John. This is the Mount of Transfiguration experience. And leadeth them up into a high mountain, apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. And his raiment became shining, exceeding white as snow, as no fuller on earth can white them. And there appeared unto them Elias with Moses, and they talked with Jesus. And Peter answered and said unto Jesus, Master, it is good for us to be here. And let us make three tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, and one for Elias. For he wist not what to say, for they were sore afraid. And there was a cloud that overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud, saying, This is my beloved Son, hear him. And suddenly, when they looked around about, they saw no man anymore, save Jesus only with themselves. So in verse 2, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John. So Peter, James, and John are the direct objects of the verb took. That's who he took. He took three disciples. He didn't take the 12. He took three, Peter, James, and John, three particular ones. Now, notice also it says, he led them up into a high mountain apart by themselves. This is a good example of what they call a pleonasm. A pleonasm is a redundancy in language. That would be like saying, this is such an intelligent, witty, no, that wouldn't be. Let's say, this is such a smart and intelligent group, you know, that you all deserve an A. That's a redundancy. Smart and intelligent are nearly synonymous. That's a pleonasm. Maybe not a real good example of one, but it is one. And so this is what we have here. Because it says, he took them apart by themselves. Well, you could say he took them by themselves, or you could say he took them apart, and it means the same thing. Why did he double it up there and say apart by themselves, pleonastically? Well, first of all, we see that this is a prepositional phrase, of course, by themselves, and it strengthens the adverb apart. So he took apart by themselves. So apart Modify is an adverb modifying the verb took, and then the prepositional phrase by themselves further modifies that. Led is the verb they're modifying when they led them up to the mountain. Now, the question arises as to whether the author has any specific purpose in utilizing the principle of redundancy, and we know from Bible study that he always has a purpose somewhere, somehow, in using a rather unusual figure of speech. And I haven't studied this deep enough to be able to say dogmatically what it is in this case, except that maybe he's further amplifying the truth that there is going to be a group that will be separated from the nine, that will be coming into a fuller revelation of God. But in order to come into that fuller revelation of God, they would have to be disassociated from those that are down lower, because you had to be up on the mountain if that's where he's going to be transfigured. You couldn't be down where the others are. So apart by themselves, you know, come out from among them and be ye separate, saith the Lord. Touch not the unclean thing. Come out of Babylon, my people. Now that's a spiritual application. And it may not be the only reason why the redundancy is there, but I see it as being one reason, because look at Revelation 12. If you want to see separation, you see it right there. The birth of the man-child from out of the church. So again, you're looking at structure, and what looks like to be just dead, dry stubble that you're just kind of looking at and comparing this grammatical relationships can turn out to be a revelation when you look at it and say, well, now why did he say apart by themselves? See, why did he stress that again? That's a redundancy. All right? Verse 2, it goes on and it says he was transfigured before them. So before them is another prepositional phrase. Here it modifies the verb transfigured. And it suggests the place of the transfiguration, that is, in their presence. And of course, the antecedent of the pronoun them is the group of the three disciples. Them, who was them? Peter, James, and John. Now, again, you say, well, big deal. What's the significance? Well, why was it transfigured before them instead of somewhere else? Why didn't it just say he was transfigured? It could have, and you still would have supplied before them, because you knew that he went up with Peter, James, and John. Because it would have been rather illogical to infer that they were behind a bush somewhere and didn't see him being transfigured. So then why did he bother saying before them? Well, maybe it was to show us the truth that God wants his glory to be shown to us. And it has to be shown to us before it can be shown through us. For example, 2 Corinthians 3:18, we reflecting the image of God as in a mirror are changed into that same image and likeness by the Spirit of God. And so, you know, you could draw a wealth of sermonic material just from looking at these phrases and saying, now why did he say that? Now how does this relate to that? Now where does this fit? How does this modify that? And it isn't even so much important as to whether the points that I make from these examples are all that dogmatically true and the only ones that you can see, but the principle is what you see is the point I'm trying to show you, and that's the main thing. Don't get too caught up in the example. Then in verse 3, his raiment became shining, or as in I think it's the ASV, his garments became glistening. And the King James says exceeding white as snow, and the ASV simply says intensely white. And the King James says, as no fuller on earth can white them. And the ASV says, as no fuller on earth could bleach them. A little bit different there. So you've got a predicate participle, glistening. His garments became glistening. And it modifies the subject garments. What happened to his garments? They became glistening. Or, as King James has it, shining. The adverb intensely modifies the adjective white. In your version, in King James, it's white as snow. It's intensely white in the ASV. It modifies white. It wasn't just white, it was intensely white, or white as snow. And again, why? The point. And why not just say white? Because he's trying to perhaps emphasize the holiness of God. And that there's holiness, and then there's God's holiness, which is in a whole other plane. It's intensely white. It's something that is that seems to strike awe in his creation when they behold it. It's an intensity to God's nature in relationship to man. And then there's as is a comparative connective. As no four on earth could wipe them. As it's a connective, it's a comparative connective. See, in other words, let me check the King James here. So as it says, so as in the King James, it's a connective, like you could say and. So it's a connective, like a conjunction, but it's a comparative connective. It's white, as white as no fuller could do it. So it's comparing two things, white with white that a fuller could do, and whiter than any fuller could do. So it's a comparative connective. So you're seeing relationships here, structural relationships. So the comparison is between the glistening, intense, white quality of Jesus' garments and the clause, no fuller on earth could bleach them or wipe them. And in effect, no modifies the entire clause, and not only its subject. And then fuller, the prepositional phrase on earth qualifies the subject fuller. No fuller on earth. And implies the event is the work of perhaps a heavenly fuller, a heavenly cleaner. No fuller or cleaner on earth could do it, but God, the heavenly fuller, as it were, can bring that kind of whiteness because, well, from the obvious standpoint that he was God, but also from the standpoint that even as to his humanity, because of God in working Jesus Christ, it was a whiteness and a holiness that came from a heavenly source and not from an earthly works righteousness, man-oriented, see, source. Then in verse 4, there appeared unto them Elias with Moses. Of course, you've got a prepositional phrase again, to them or unto them. And it's an indirect object of the verb appeared unto them. And it suggests to whom the appearance was made, appeared unto them. Since the pronoun them is plural, it again indicates that the disciples were aware of the appearance of Elijah with Moses. If it appeared unto them, then they were aware of it. They saw it. Elijah is mentioned first, although chronologically Moses preceded him. And that's perhaps worthy of further investigation. Why? Moses came first, then Elijah. But here it's Elias with Moses. And so that could lead you down a path of further investigation that could perhaps bring some truth. Of course, the preposition with used to relate Elijah and Moses instead of other perhaps possible connectives. Why is it Elias with Moses instead of Elias and Moses? See, another question could come to mind. And again, you always want to check out the Greek if there's any question to make sure it wasn't Kai in the Greek and the King James just for variety, which they often did, just for variety, just for the sake of prose, prosaically stating it, beautiful language. They switch it around. That's one of the main reasons why they would not always translate one word with the same English word, even if it could be, because they wanted variety. They wanted it to sound beautiful, and they succeeded in that, but at the cost of a certain degree of accuracy. So again, you could say, well, if it's not Kai, if it's soon, or whatever the word would be there for with, why? Elias with Moses. Maybe he's trying to show a unity between the revelation of God through Elijah and the revelation of God through Moses. So it's Elias with Moses. They go together, the law and the prophets. See, whatever he's trying to say through that, and not just one and another, in which case you would see a distinction rather than a connection. Verse 4 says, and they were talking with Jesus, or the King's ASV, they were talking to Jesus. Elias and Moses, of course, are the antecedents of the pronoun they. They, who is they? Elias and Moses. Thus indicating that they were both speaking to Jesus. And to Jesus, the indirect object of talking. They were both talking or speaking to Jesus. So it means that Elijah and Moses were talking to Jesus, not the disciples. Whereas some people could maybe misinterpret that if they didn't understand the relationship between a pronoun and its antecedent. They might say, well, who was talking with Jesus? Was it Elijah and Moses, or was it Peter, James, and John? Well, context clearly shows that it was Elijah and Moses that were talking with Jesus there. It'd be interesting to know what that discussion was about. I don't know what they said. You're puzzled, Keith. You don't know what I just said.
Can you repeat that one more time?
Okay. The pronoun they in verse 4, they were talking with Jesus, has its antecedent meaning the nouns that it refers to, in Elias and Moses. So you could say, and Elias and Moses were talking with Jesus, just as well as you could say, and they were. But you just use the pronoun to avoid the redundancy of using the nouns every time they're referred to. And all I'm saying is, if you didn't understand that, the relationship between a pronoun and its antecedent in context, you could fall into the pitfall of thinking that it was Peter, James, and John that were talking with Jesus there, and not Elijah and Moses. Then verse 5, Peter answered and said unto Jesus, Master, it's good for us to be here. Or ASV, Peter said to Jesus, Master, it's well that we are here. Let's make three booths, or instead of tabernacles, three booths, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Man always wants to institutionalize every experience of God. There's a pretty obvious truth you can draw from that one. Now, it is good what? It is good for us to be here. Or the ASV, it is good that we are here. That's a clause that is subordinate to the main sentence, and it's modifying the verb, it is good, and so it's an adverbial subordinate clause. And it modifies the main clause, it is well. It is well what? It is well for us to be here, or that we are here. And it especially modifies the predicate adjective well. Now you could preach a sermon on that. It's good for you to be where? In the presence of Jesus, and in the presence of the saints of God that are revealed through the Word of God. That's where it's good to be, or well to be. The subject of the statement, let us make three booths, is in the first person and is in the plural. Us. Let us make three booths. And the object of the verb make is booths. Which, interestingly enough, is modified by the adjective three. Let us make three booths. And the apposition, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah, qualifies the three booths, indicating for whom they should be built. In this statement, notice, Moses is mentioned before Elijah. First it was Elias with Moses. Now it's one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. And again, is there any reason why it's reversed? There may be. And you'd have to check that out further. And then verse 6, he wist not what to say, or for he did not know what to say, for they were exceedingly afraid. So when a person doesn't know what to say, especially if they're extroverted, like Peter appears to have been, they just talk, they just babble, you know, run at the mouth, because he was afraid. Now you've got two coordinate causal clauses explaining the reasons for the facts stated. Two coordinate causal clauses explaining the reasons for the facts stated. What's the first one? For he did not know what to say. It's causal because it says for. It's showing the cause, you see. So it's a causal clause, and it's coordinate with another one. So it's a coordinate causal clause. And it gives the cause for his statement in verse 5. Why did he say, let's make three tabernacles? For or because he didn't know what to say. So it's a causal clause. And then the second clause, for they were exceedingly afraid, explains the reason for the first clause of verse 6. For he did not know what to say. In other words, why didn't he know what to say? Because he was afraid. So you see the progression? Because he was afraid, he didn't know what to say. And because he didn't know what to say, he said something stupid, or something silly at least. The subject of the second clause is plural, for they were exceedingly afraid. So Peter wasn't the only one whose knees were knocking. James and John's were as well. But Peter's felt that. You felt the embarrassment of a silent moment in the company of strangers, perhaps. And you knew you wanted to keep the old conversational ball rolling, and you were a little bit afraid. You didn't know what to say, so you just said something. And maybe you talked about something totally out of context, irrelevant, and rather silly. But you said it because you were afraid and you didn't know what else to say. So you said that. So notice though, the subject of the first clause was singular, the subject of the second clause was plural. Peter didn't know what to say, but they were afraid. Now what does that mean? Well, maybe James and John had something to say, but they were so afraid, you know, that they didn't want to say it. Well, what did they know to say? Well, maybe what they could have said was, and you could speculate on that, you could bring up all kinds of possibilities. You know, what would you say in that situation? Lord, what's going on? Well, what is this I'm witnessing? Why are Moses and Elijah here? You know, where's Samuel and Jeremiah? Why these two? What are you trying to show me, Lord? I mean, obviously he was trying to show him something. Why did he take him up into the mountain in the first place if he wasn't? Show him something. But you know how man gets. He cowers in fear, and in a sense rightfully so, in the divine presence of Almighty God. And they were all afraid, but he didn't know what to say. Maybe they knew what to say, but through fear they weren't even willing to say anything. And so you can draw a homiletical truth from that. And that is, there's a lot of people that know what to say and have the ability, but they're so afraid they won't even step out and say it. Whereas some of the people that aren't the wisest and don't always know what the right thing is to say, at least have the faith and boldness to step out and say it. Open mouth, insert foot, closed mouth. Well, if you don't make any mistakes, you'll never learn. And if you minister, you're going to make mistakes. So we're fast to judge Peter for being so silly, but James and John were afraid too. And they might have even known something a little more intelligent to say, but they sat on it. They wouldn't say it. You wouldn't notice that necessarily if you hadn't been looking at, you know, what some people would consider nitpicky things, relationships. He didn't know what to say, singular subject. They were afraid, plural subject. That's all we're looking at, laws of structure. Notice also the adverb exceedingly, which modifies the predicate adjective afraid. They weren't just afraid, they were exceedingly afraid. And so now you know why maybe they didn't pipe up. It's one thing to be a little bit intimidated, another thing to be exceedingly afraid. And so it's intensified here. Verse 7, there was a cloud that overshadowed them. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved son, hear him," or ASV, "listen to him." Now, you've got a verb, overshadowed. So the cloud was doing something. It was overshadowing them. So the verb is overshadowed. And the pronoun them is the direct object of that verb, isn't it? Who was the cloud overshadowing? Them. Now the question arises, though, as to the antecedent of this pronoun. Who's the them that was being overshadowed? In other words, was it overshadowing just Peter, James, and John? Or was it overshadowing Peter, James, John, and Jesus? Or was it overshadowing Peter, James, John, Jesus, Moses, and Elijah? Or was it only overshadowing Jesus, Moses, and Elijah, and not Peter, James, and John? So it's not always cut and dried case as to what the antecedent of a pronoun is. And you've got to go back to the context and try to come down on one side or the other. And then the voice came out of the same cloud that overshadowed them. And then the statement made by the voice is given, although the voice is not identified, since it is preceded by the indefinite article A. A voice came out of the cloud. Well, it's pretty obvious who the object is. Who the subject is, God, is speaking out. But again, you might ask yourself, why did the Holy Spirit say a voice? Well, maybe he wasn't so intent on showing you the source of it, which he knew you would imply anyway, or infer from it. But he wanted to more stress the fact that it was a voice that came out. It was knowledge that was going to give them that information that they were too afraid to ask about, see? So a voice. The subject of this statement is the demonstrative pronoun this. This is my beloved son. There's the subject, this, which refers, of course, to Jesus. And then both the pronoun my son, and the adjective beloved, my beloved son, qualify the predicate noun son. So Jesus is a son, but he's not just any son. He's my son. He's God's son. And he's not just God's son. He's God's beloved son. So he was telling a world of information there in saying, this is my beloved son. It sounds almost like a truism. What's the big deal about that? Well, Moses and Elijah have their positions, but look at Jesus, my beloved son. Contrast, perhaps, being shown between Moses and Elijah and Jesus. In fact, they might have heard Moses and Elijah say things about, you know, when his death should be accomplished and so forth. In fact, doesn't it even say something in a parallel passage? I can't remember now. I'd have to have a harmony with me, but a parallel passage may even mention something about the subject matter of the conversation between Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. I don't know, but I think it does say, I think they were asking him about when his death should be accomplished. So again, the focus was not on Moses and Elijah so much as it was on Jesus. And you could say that the book of Hebrews is an amplification on that whole Mount of Transfiguration experience. God, who in former sundry times and in diverse manners spake unto the fathers through the prophets, or in the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us in His Son, who He made the image of His invisible person, and so on and so forth. And to which of the angels said He, You are my Son? But unto the Son He saith, Thy throne, O God, is a throne forever. So then you can go off into the whole book of Hebrews and see how that expands on this experience. Then the exhortation, hear Him, or listen to Him, follows the statement of the fact, this is my beloved Son. That's why you should listen to Him, because He is God's beloved Son. And so obviously a relation is implied by that order. He didn't reverse it and say, listen to Him, He is my beloved Son. Because if He did it that way, He probably would have said, listen to Him, for He is my beloved Son. Then you'd have one of those tip-off modifier words. But since He didn't, since He said, this is my beloved Son, listen to Him, then you still should see an order there. Listen to Him because He's my Son. And then, verse 8, suddenly, when they had looked about, they saw no man anymore, save Jesus only with themselves. ASV, and suddenly looking around, which is not in the King James, well, I guess it is, and they looked about. Suddenly looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. Now, you've got an adverb, suddenly, but it could modify either the participle looking or the verb saw. In other words, suddenly they looked about, or suddenly they saw. It could be either one. The context would have to define which, or it could even be both. They looked around suddenly, and they saw no one else suddenly, save themselves and Jesus. Of course, the subject is they. They, Peter, James, and John, looked around. Notice the connective but, or I think the King James has saved. Save Jesus only. The ESV is but Jesus only. Same thing, save Jesus. In other words, accept Jesus or but Jesus. And there seems to suggest a relationship. It seems to be suggesting a relationship between anyone and Jesus. They didn't see anyone but Jesus only. So there's a relationship between not seeing anyone but seeing Jesus. It's showing you that you should connect those two. Note also the succession of terms emphasizing the factor. No longer, or anyone, but only. Notice the emphasis that is there. They saw no longer anyone anymore save Jesus only. Why is it all of a sudden focusing down to that? Because now we could say that God has drawn this thing to its conclusion as to what He was trying to tell them through the transfiguration experience. And that is, this is it right here. This is the one. This is my Son. Don't look at anybody else, Peter. Don't look at James. Don't look at John. Don't look at man. Don't look at yourself. Don't look at the prophets. Don't look at Moses. Don't look at the Word. So much as you look at Jesus only. And so their whole lives were perhaps focused on Him from that day forward as a result of that experience. More as shown by the physical fact that they saw no one save Jesus only. Now, a few comments regarding this second example. The first one I've already made, and that is that I made these observations solely on the basis of an English translation, in this case the ASV. And that was done for purposes of illustration. It would have been more difficult to illustrate the point if I'd had to go into the Greek to do it. Difficult for me, and perhaps difficult for you as well. And so realize that you have to be looking at the Greek in order to make sure that what you're looking at is not something that's been supplied either correctly or incorrectly in the English translation and what the relationships are. But once you have ascertained that you've got a good translation from the Greek, then you can, if you don't have the ability to go into the Greek, drop the Greek and look at the English, and you'll still see the same relationships. They'll still be there. Although, remember how sometimes we didn't know what the antecedent of a certain pronoun was. And the Greek wouldn't necessarily make that any more clear than the English. So you've got just as much right to arrive at your interpretation as what the antecedent of a pronoun would be on the basis of the English as you would in the Greek in that case. Yes?
In verse 4, you said that Elias and Moses was the antecedent for they.
Right.
Is there a grammatical rule that proves that the antecedent cannot be them?
I don't know of any rule. Grammatical rules are really just observations that are made, on the basis of observing patterns. in the Greek, and then coming up with a, you know, coming up with a statement or a theorem. And I can't quote you, you know, chapter, page, and verse from, you know, Robertson's grammar of a rule. I would say you just have to check on that. I really don't know. But I would say I would say that if there is a rule, it would say something like this: that the antecedent to the pronoun would be the last stated. You know, it would be more reasonable for the more recently stated pronoun nouns to be the right, the antecedent of a pronoun rather than the ones that are more distant.
Because it seems like, especially in the King James Version, a lot of times the way things are worded with pronouns, the antecedent will be something that's not closest in proximity.
Yeah.
You just kind of have to look at the context.
I think the thing that nails it down in this case is the and or chi, which tells you that you're looking at one sentence there. You're looking at one thought. There appeared unto them Elias with Moses, and they talked with Jesus. The and ties it right together there, so that you can't jump back into an earlier context. Yeah.
There's a rule in English grammar that a connective is supposed to join items of equal weight for impact. And that would say that Moses and Elijah, and the first thing that's joined, Moses and Elijah, and the second thing, the action would be joined, the appearing of the talking.
Now, Keith brought up a good point, though, in bringing that, is there sometimes room for a difference of opinion as to the analysis of structural relations? And the definite answer to that is yes. Just as we saw in that one, and there was a case there where we didn't know what the antecedent was, or, you know, the pronoun, it could have been the disciples only, or disciples plus Jesus plus Moses and Elijah, or Jesus plus Moses and Elijah. And so, just like in interpretation, so in observation, there is room for difference of opinion as to these relationships. But still, the premises remain the same, and the process remains the same either way. And that's what we're looking at here. Also, I'm not laying this out again as some rigid formula to always be followed in every Bible passage. This is more suggestive. You would be chaining yourself to a ball and chain of Bible study if you felt that you had to go through this, you know, detailed and assiduous a method every time you studied a Bible verse. You want to have liberty to be led by the Spirit when you read this book. But the fact remains that adding this to your repertoire of a Bible background, you can gain fantastic, I believe, information from the Scriptures just by looking, because God uses our mind. God uses what we have in terms of mind and ability, and the more background we have, the more methods and analytical reasoning and logical abilities that we have, the more things that are there for God to anoint as we look and observe the Scripture for God to pull out to us. See? Yes.
Kind of a backtracking. A minute ago, you were talking about Greek and Latin. The question I have is, when you have such time that you're going all the way down to rock bottom, example, I did what you brought out earlier in class, and theology was that I was doing. I took the Scripture and I wrote it out in the Greek, or the Hebrew. What I needed to know was the relationship of the word to the word. Can you, I'm not a Greek scholar or Hebrew scholar, can you, just by the books and what we've got, open up an interlinear and do the same thing with, it'll say, and he said, or and kind of diagram the Greek without, being a Greek scholar, at least get an idea.
The more you know about English grammar, the better off you're going to be. And I say this with the qualification that you're looking at a different language, but still the principles basically are the same. But the more you know about English grammar, the better off you'll be in looking at it, for example, a Greek sentence, particularly Greek, more than Hebrew, and analyzing it. And I would suggest anybody who's interested in getting into this area further that they pick up a good English grammar. And if you'd like, next week after next or something, I could give you or recommend a few titles, because I've looked at a few recently here for my library orientation class when I was teaching some things on note-taking and so forth. I got into a few grammars, and I can give you some names of some recent ones, or you could even go into the Burian Library or something and see what they've got. But I think every student of the Bible, especially ministerial, should have a good English grammar at his disposal, because he's writing and he's doing, we don't remember all these things. And it's good to know what these words are, predicate adjective, predicate nominative, so forth, how these things relate. And just have a passing knowledge of it. You might want to get a short, condensed one, one that just gives you a quick overview rather than a long detail. And you want to get more of a reference grammar, kind of like Dana and Maddie is to the Greek, more than one that's an exegetical or inductive approach. And that would be a help, just to brush up on that. There was even a handout, I don't know if they still have it, which was given to those who took, I think it was Greek orientation some time ago, and it was a handout of English grammar. And it was nice, very concise and succinct, gave examples. And if that's still alive and kicking, you might want to pick up on that and use it. Okay.
So the principles then are pretty, they do like carry over into the Greek.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of, because of tenses, whatever, that are going to,
well, there are differences in the layout, the syntactical layout of the languages, some vast differences. For example, in English, word order is extremely important to show you what words are modifying what, which are adjectives modifying nouns and so forth. Whereas in the Greek, order is very, very secondary, and accident becomes more important, or the form of the word, the morphological form or spelling of the word, regardless of where it is in the sentence, will tell you what kind of a word it is, and if it's a noun or an adjective, and as far as what it modifies, you'll have to read through it and understand, pick up from the context what other word in the sentence is modifying. Oftentimes, so there's probably the biggest difference between the two there, structurally.
And one of the biggest problems in Greek is that the part that's old and thin, you run into a lot of trouble trying to correspond to the English unless you have the Kingdom of England. You can tell from that where the parts of mm-hmm. are and the infinitive by the ing and the two. That'll help out quite a bit. If you try to diagram the crazy.
See, that's where even translation becomes interpretation.
Yeah.
Translators are interpreting in certain instances when they decide what word is modifying what word, and of course how they're going to translate that word as well. And so one device to help you, once you've got your interlinear out and you've got the corresponding English and Greek words, is to see how some different translations have translated that, and therefore you can see what they feel is modifying what and the structural layout that they are giving. Another help would be word studies, Greek word studies. Usually more so than commentaries, unless it's a commentary on the original text,
mm-hmm.
will especially Robertson's in the Greek, will give you syntactical information. This word modifies that word, this word relates to that word. Vincent is more on a one word at a time basis, giving you the etymology of that word and background of it, whereas Robertson gives you a little bit more syntax and interrelationships between the words there, and that can be a help in the Greek. And the better, more critical, exegetical, and philological commentaries tend to do that too. George?
For Greek, what is file 1 for Greek orientation?
Okay, file 1 in Greek and in Greek orientation. You might want to go ahead and pick that up if you don't have it from publications. You can say you've got my permission to pick one up. You know, make sure they're extra copies so that they won't take them from the students, and that'll be helpful. Okay. Next point to keep in mind is that all relationships do not have the same degree of significance. For example, in the passage that we read, some things were stated and they were obvious and they really didn't seem that significant. Well, that modifies that and, you know, it's obvious. Others, when you see the connection, a light seems to come on and you see, hey, that's significant that it says him here and them there. But do keep in mind that sometimes things which at first seem to be insignificant can become significant later on in the ballgame. And so what you need to do is absorb like a sponge. Somewhat indiscriminately is what I mean. In other words, don't place limitations on your perception. When you're reading the Bible, don't limit yourself as to what you look for. Otherwise, you're going to hinder your receptivity. Now, I know that you do have to put some limitations on that. Nobody can be a perfect sponge just indiscriminately absorbing everything. In fact, if you do that, you won't be able to make heads or tails of it anyway. There is a certain critical evaluation process that goes on inductive, and that's why nobody is purely objective. No method is purely inductive, because the minute your eyes lay You lay your eyes on that page, you are interpreting what you read in the light of what you know, and even in terms of language and grammar and understanding. But still, don't shackle yourself just because you've got a foundational theology behind you. And I'm not saying throw that away either, but I'm saying try to be like a sponge. Try to break out the walls of the limitations in your perception that limit you to always looking for unfolded revelation of God, or always looking for cause and effect, or always looking for this, or always looking for that. Break out of that mold as much as you can and just look as objectively as a scientist would try to analyze a certain chemical or substance. And when you do that, you're going to start seeing new truths in areas that you perhaps have not seen before. And the next point, which is kind of an elaboration of something I mentioned in the previous point, and that is that at times, observation and interpretation are almost inseparable. They're almost the same thing. You are interpreting while you are observing. You can't keep clear-cut steps in actual Bible study, and we know that. We're not trying to be idealistic, saying every time you study the Bible, it's observation, you know, evaluation, correlation, interpretation. You don't do it that way. Sometimes it's all in one big package deal when you do it. But still, that does not denigrate from the worth of looking at it and breaking it down in this order, because you should be able to distinguish between the steps. If you can't, then your procedures and results are going to become blurred, and as a result, relatively meaningless. You should realize there's a difference between observing something and then interpreting what you're observing, see. Also, you're not necessarily aware of all these minute observations each time you study a passage. You may study Mark 9 one time and pick up a few things. You might study it a week later and pick up some other details. But whenever it's necessary, and I think that's our salient point there, whenever it's necessary, you should be capable of this kind of minute analysis. I really feel that. And you don't have to be a Greek grammarian to do it, see. As long as you feel you're on firm ground in the original text with the translation you're working with, you can go into your translation and observe these relationships. And this becomes especially necessary in what you can call argumentative type of literature. And the classic cases are called the Pauline epistles, where he's going on long argumentative discourses. And then you need to be able to make minute detailed analyses and see relationships between clauses and phrases and words. Now, that brings me to an assignment. Just got time to give it to you. Praise the Lord. I am positive. Well, I'm almost positive. Well, I'm pretty sure that this assignment is not going to be of the magnitude of that Revelation 3, 8 through 10, Donnybrook. So this one, I'm going to ask you to observe the structural relationships in Romans chapters 5 and 6. Observe the structural relations in light of everything we've just taught you here under observation. You observe and look for these relations in Romans 5 and 6. Note especially the relations indicated by connectives, prepositional phrases, and dependent clauses. Be on the lookout for those three connectives, like and, so, but. Prepositional phrases, you know, in the earth, from heaven, see, that type of thing, against wrath. And dependent clauses, which you know what they are, cannot stand alone and modify usually something in the independent clause. Look also for relations which are implicit rather than explicit. And we talked about that last week. An explicit relationship was one which is right there, obviously, on the surface, shown by some key word or phrase. But an implicit relationship is one that is merely implied by reading the through the context. And those that missed last week will want to pick up the tape to get that material to better understand that point. And then, when you see those relations, and when you see those connections in Romans 5 and 6, I want you to classify them in view of the lecture points we gave. Well, this is a dependent clause, and this is a connective that connects these two. Describe them in light of the lecture points and headings that we gave you. And then, last but certainly not least, attempt to indicate the significance of your discoveries for the interpretation. of those passages. Attempt to indicate the significance of your discoveries for the interpretation of those chapters, and that's due next week. Okay? Now, that shouldn't be too onerous a task. I don't think it is. I know it's two chapters, but some of those sentences are, you know, so long. Some of those things are so long, they're practically like, you know, two or three verses long, and it's just one thing. So see if you can get both chapters done. Yes?
You just want to take out the most significant ones.
Right. I'm going to release you from the obligation to try to find every single structural relation in those two chapters, and I'm going to ask you to try to hit the highlights. And that should ease a little bit of the burden off. The more important ones. The last point was attempts to indicate the significance of your discoveries for interpretation, like we did in that Mark passage. You know, I told you this modifies that. Now, what's the significance? Well, it means that Jesus was revealed just to Peter, James, and John, not to the others. So there's a significance of that in terms of a spiritual application. That type of thing. Yes?
Real quick. Don just drilled this for 2 hours on preposition.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things he just brought up in the last hour was Romans 5:6, and we have two scriptures. A lot of the prepositions are totally inaccurate translations. We can do it totally at the wrong conclusion.
Uh-huh.
So my question is, do you want us to use more than one translation?
Well, that's a good question. That's an excellent question. We should be standard and accurate with what we do here. What do you think? Should you use the NES? Can we just settle on a more accurate translation and have you do that? We don't want you to have to go to the Greek, so it's going to have to be something. Yes?
For those of us in the Greek class that want to do this in Greek, would that be okay with you?
Well, I would say if you give translations
with,
of it,
with
translation,
with the word.
You could do it from the Greek. I'll tell you what, I want you to do this in order to be a little bit more accurate in a more accurate translation. I guess NES is a good one to start with.
John said Rotherham.
Uh-huh. Well, we talked about Rotherham earlier, the way he lays things out being good. Let's do that. Let's do it from Rotherham's translation. Okay, that's what we'll use.
What's the format we'll work on something like that?
I'll leave the format up to you. One way to do it would be to do it verse by verse. Chapter 5, dependent clause modifies this, connective modifies that, giving the phrase and explaining what it is. That would be one way to do it.
Yeah.